to Autograph with me, Susan Medeiros. My guest this week is author and foreign policy analyst James Peck. He's joining me to talk about his new book, Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights, in which he argues that Washington utilizes human rights as an ideological weapon to reach its means abroad and in the United States as well. Lots to talk about. Stay tuned. Noted historian and foreign policy analyst James Peck is founder of the Culture and Civilization of China Project at Yale University Press and the China International Publishing Group in Beijing. He is the author of Washington's China and has written for the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, among other publications. Peck's latest book is titled Ideal Illusions, How the U.S. Government Co-opted Human Rights. The United States has long been hailed as a powerful force for global human rights. Now drawing on thousands of documents from the CIA, the National Security Council, the Pentagon, and development agencies, James Peck shows in blunt detail how Washington has shaped human rights into a potent ideological weapon for purposes having little to do with rights and everything to do with furthering America's global reach. I sat down with James Peck in New York City and started our discussion by asking him about the book's title, the nature of co-opting human rights, and what motivated him to write Ideal Illusions.
Well, maybe I should start with the motivation. It really came out of rethinking the period of my life in the 1960s anti-war movement, when human rights first became a publicly prominent language in the United States. Because before then, human rights really wasn't much of a factor. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights existed, but it wasn't part of the public debate. That really only began amidst the Vietnam War era as the old anti-communist consensus began to break down. And as it did, the human rights language began to emerge. And what I was struck by was, and I think it's very core to the origins and the development ever since, was what human rights at its beginning turned away from. And what I mean by that is this. There were two great movements in the 60s and 70s. One was the peace movement. And in the peace movement, the great issues were war, aggression, occupation, self-determination, violence, and sometimes various forms of struggle had to do with Vietnam and other areas of the world, the military-industrial complex, the nature of American power. All those things were part of what the peace movement was raising and part of the raise through Vietnam. The human rights movement, when it began, and the language which developed, turned away from the issue of war. It's concerned with the laws of war. Has no stand on war. Has no stand on aggression. Has no stand against occupation. It's only a question of the laws of occupation. It took no stand on the preeminent position of American power. So there was that one whole core, and I thought, well, there are many wonderful activists involved in human rights, but why not these issues? And then the other great movement was the civil rights movement. And that was a movement for, obviously, racial justice, but it was also an issue about substantive equality. I mean, as Martin Luther King Jr. used to say, it's not enough just to be able to sit at the lunch counter. You have to be able to live and meet and have a decent life, to be able to have economic sustenance. And that's why King, in his later years, raised questions about distribution of wealth and power, corporate struggle, collective corporate power, and means of collective struggle. And indeed, no one brought the two issues together better, the two movements better, than Martin Luther King in the last years of his life, when they said a peace movement needs the insights of the civil rights movement and a civil rights movement must have the insights of the peace movement. And so what happened in that period, I think, which is something I had puzzled about ever since, was, well, why then did the human rights movement not even make equality a major issue? Why, indeed, as human rights has become more and more prominent, has inequality grown to historic proportions, not simply in the world, but in the United States itself? And so you had a cluster of issues that were in my mind in the context of then beginning to look at how the American government was going to be using human rights.
And basically, so you argue that in order to establish a global role, you need to establish an ideology which you just argued started in the 1970s to an extent, and we're seeing now. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yes. I mean, I think the key is really to see why the old anti-communist ethos, which had really worked from the 1946 on, did begin to break apart. And as it began to break apart, and the world had become more economically integrated in the 60s and 70s, the United States did feel it needed another means of explaining its role in the world, legitimizing its power, and also, which is often underestimated, to have the national security managers themselves inculcate the faith themselves in their own way, in the words they use to describe American power, which is very important. I'm very concerned about which words are used and why. Because when Brzezinski and the Carter administration first brought in the issue of human rights, they did so and thought very carefully about how are we going to use these words and how are we going to shape them and define them so that they are beneficial to aspects of American power. For example, we stress the individual-centric elements of human rights, the more legal component, the moderate non-revolutionary aspects. Oh, we're not against economic needs, we're not against this, but these should all be seen through the prism of a non-violent or cautious or law, rule of law kind of thinking, which ends up as a means of justifying a certain kind of American approach at home and also in opposition to certain kind of radical changes abroad or opposition to group changes they didn't wish to see. And people like Brzezinski, you know, as I delineate in the book, you know, they wrote memos about how to do this, how to create a human rights environment, how to create universities that would have chairs in human rights, set up magazines, set up awards. Now, what they were trying to do was to situate the creation of a new language. And to put it in a nutshell, human rights really becomes the initial, the soul of American foreign policy, as Carter called it. But then human rights also adds on to it in the Reagan years, democratization and all the language that came with that. And then in the Carter years, humanitarianism, and particularly humanitarian war. In the Clinton years, which we then see explode in the Bush years to bring them all together into the wars of the Bush years.
Using the words of Washington's leaders when they are speaking among themselves, Peck tracks the rise of human rights from its dismissal in the Cold War years as, quote, fuzzy-minded, to its calculated adoption after the Vietnam War as a rationale for American foreign engagement. He considers such milestones as the fight for Soviet dissidents, Tiananmen Square, and today's war on terror, exposing in the process of how the human rights movement has too often failed to challenge Washington's strategies. Can you elaborate a little more about the evolution of language of human rights from the Carter years to the Reagan years to the Clinton years? And I guess, you know, Vietnam was used to expand the concern with human rights in a way. It was Carter's way, so to say. But for a lot of people, this is somewhat ironic. How is Vietnam associated with the issue of human rights?
I think that's an excellent question because in a way, human rights is a way to get beyond Vietnam. It was a way of saying, if only Americans had lived up to its ideals, they wouldn't have done what they did in Vietnam. And rather than giving you a way of thinking and an insight into Vietnam, that becomes an obfuscation. Because what it's saying is, if we'd lived up to those ideals, we wouldn't have done it. And that's not who we are. But if the Russians invade Afghanistan in the 80s, that says who they are. So there's a contrast that lets the U.S. off the hook. It's a way of saying our ideals let us off if we lived up to them. And that doesn't give you much of an insight into power. It doesn't give you an insight into the operations of corporate military power and the other workings of the American global system. Because it's key and it's critical in understanding American power in that it is the only global power. And it is the only power that does think globally in terms of its military and economic might. Other nations may think about the world, but it's only the United States that figures out how to calculate the way the various regions relate to each other. Well, human rights became a first key element, a very moral element of the Carter years. As I say, the soul of American foreign policy. But human rights didn't necessarily provide the full agenda, because part of what had also been challenged in Vietnam was nation building, modernization theory, the notion that the United States could step in and guide the channel the forces of change in various parts of the world. So Reagan brought in democratization, which is his way of saying we need to start going into countries, whether it's Central America or other places, and we need to start training them in elections. But then you realize it's not just elections, it's the free press, it's the market, it's business. You can go right through a long list of things. And whether it was the symbolic pinprick of it all, the National Endowment of Democracy, or a whole range of other means to legitimize various kinds of penetration of American power in these regions, that was what was called democratization. Mm-hmm. And then and yet humanitarianism was another component which came with the Clinton years. And it's important to realize humanitarianism had almost always been associated with groups like the Red Cross. We don't take sides. We're neutral. We help the refugees. We help the innocent. We help the victims. We go in. Sometimes we get caught up in civil wars, but our idea is to remain neutral. But in the 90s, that shifted. Humanitarianism became taking sides, whether it was in Yugoslavia or other places. And it became an instrument of war, up to war, I should say. And that shows you the transformation, and it's very critical in the language. And so in the U.S. documents, the government documents, which the human rights community began increasingly to use, humanitarianism and development and human rights all become part of the same language, same universe of language. So when the United States becomes involved, say, in Afghanistan, you'll read human rights reports about the need for human rights-based development, human rights-based humanitarianism, and these all become ways not of questioning the nature of America's involvement so much as it is legitimizing its presence. It doesn't preclude criticism, and that's part of what's important. The national security managers knew, as was true of anti-communism, there'd be huge amounts of criticism, but not on the fundamentals, and that's what's pivotal.
And when these wars are fought, if, for example, the United States fails in Vietnam, Vietnam becomes a quote-unquote mistake once again.
It becomes a mistake, not a manifestation of aspects of how American power operated earlier and in ways comparable since.
So the anti-communist ethos was replaced by human rights. Do you think that democratization took the place of human rights in the Bush era, perhaps more than being integrated as in the Reagan administration and the Clinton administration? I know you talked about how these issues became integrated from Carter to Clinton, but it seems like with the issue of the so-called war on terror, it was all about democratization. We really didn't hear about issues of human rights during the Bush administration, or am I wrong?
If you look at the sentences and the documents, they're there, but you're quite right. They weren't part of the propaganda war. They weren't part of what the war of ideas, which has been going on now for 60 years. Democratization was a much more effective term in this country as well. And human rights has never been a particularly moving term in public debates in this country, outside of small circles. Civil rights, yes. Human rights, no.
The author notes that there are two currents within the larger concept of human rights. The first current emphasizes civil and political rights and embraces a moderate, democratic, step-by-step incorporation of human needs into a kind of rights-based legalism. Perhaps such rights are easier to understand in terms of individual freedom. U.S. state managers have latched on to the first current and found it useful. The second current has more to do with basic needs. It is associated with popular mass movements, revolution by populations in desperate straits, and resistance. Central to the second current are challenges to corporate power, state repression, foreign occupation, and global economic inequality, as well as labor unions and revolution.
One of the points I make in the book is there are really kind of two great currents of human rights. One is the current that Americans are used to, and that's sort of what we think of as civil rights. It's individualistic. It has many admirable things about freedom of the press, removal of racial prejudice, women's rights, gay rights. All of these things are an element of the first current. But the second current, historically, is much more about equality. It's about basic needs. It's about the upheavals in the South and in the Third World, as we spoke of it earlier, in terms of finding some ways of dealing with profound global injustices built into the world order. And that current is one that, for very obvious reasons, is not to be brought into the American mainstream debate. Now, I think it's quite right. Bush himself was much more interested in democratization and freedom. One reads his second inaugural, it's the great freedom agenda. And freedom is indeed the great code word of that transcends from anti-communism through human rights up to the present. But it's, of course, a very specific way of invoking the word so that freedom becomes a way of justifying the first current to war with those elements of the second current of human rights that go too far or are seen as radically challenging American power.
You know, it's fascinating that you're elaborating on this. I just thought about the election of our current president, Barack Obama. He stressed a lot of importance on changing the terminology that had been used during the Bush administration. Can you tell us a little about President Obama's approach in his use of language?
The unfortunate thing is the amount of language he's kept rather than the language he's changed. And I think it's a reminder that there is a limited amount an American president can do if he doesn't mobilize constituencies in the United States from outside established authority as well to push for change. I mean, the great example of change in this country is Franklin Roosevelt, and that was a president who could work with mobilized groups in the society, whether he favored them all or not. President Obama does not do that, and it shows. You can't tackle the nature of American military global power all by yourself as president unless you really educate the people to do it. Now, the one term he did change was war on terror. Now we have a war on extremists. But that was the same language that Donald Rumsfeld wanted to change originally in the war on terror. What does terrorist mean? Terrorist basically was defined by Washington as the killing of innocent civilians. Now, who's in favor of that? Sounds terrible. So it's completely a crime and it's completely immoral. Now, that's contrasted to American military operations, which may be disproportionate. So there's a question of proportionality. Target was picked, too many people were killed, but that's not a crime, per se, in the same way. So there's a moral imbalance between the two. And the notion of terrorists serves, therefore, not only as a moral element on putting the blame on the tally on one side, but it also creates a generalization, almost as mind-stopping as communism was in the 40s and 50s, that makes people frightened in this country, link up all sorts of different issues that shouldn't be linked up. And I think there's a reason, and here there is a split in the human rights community, because the American human rights groups do use the word terrorist. Amnesty International does not. And the BBC tries not to as well. So and their argument is, there are other words to describe it. I mean, if it's a bombing, it's a bombing. If it's an assassination, it's an assassination. If it's a mass slaughter, it's a mass slaughter. You describe it for what it is. Apply the label terror, and you've really ended up making people less aware, less thoughtful, less insightful into the ways of the world. So I suggest to people, try to think of the world without it. Try to think of the actions that are there, so there's a glass in front of you and you can't use that word. And I think you'd come to a much better understanding of the nature of struggles throughout the world and in the Middle East.
Ideal Illusions argues that the human rights movement must break free from Washington if it is to develop a truly uncompromising critique of power in all its forms.
The world is changing profoundly. Yet the tectonic shifts in global power now underway have barely registered on either the Obama administration or human rights leaders. But as the old world gives way, it is urgent that we rethink the meaning of human rights. And nothing presents a greater hurdle to this task than the human rights community's close, if often unwitting, links to Washington. Without such a reexamination, the human rights movement may well continue to serve Washington's ideological needs. In the end, the movement must decide, can it find a way to truly confront the abusive operations of wealth and power in all their many forms? Or will it consent to being a weapon of privileged power, seeking to protect its interests and its conscience? Well, I think the difficulty is that the NGOs, and some of which are quite wonderful. I mean, I could tell you, that, you know, in the book, the Doctors Without Borders is an example of a group that has done remarkable work and does not share the prevailing ethos about how most NGOs and human rights organizations work, because they question the link with the powers that be. Now, I think the difficulty is that the NGOs basically use the same language as Washington. And one of the elements that people underestimate is the extent to which Washington spends an enormous amount of time not only thinking about words, but creating massive distributions of materials and disseminating concepts for how the world should be understood, within which most NGO work is done.
So we read a lot about how the world has changed in your book, Ideal Illusions. I guess my final question is, what needs to be done? What path needs to be taken?
Well, I think first it's important not to have illusions about American power. That's probably not something so difficult for people outside the United States, but it's extremely important for people in the United States. And second, I think one has to begin to think about why the world has, in a way, not fundamentally improved in areas of equality, meeting basic needs, creating jobs, moving away from simply market-type thinking. We're in just the beginning stages, I think, of an enormous upheaval in the Middle East. I think it will be long, difficult, torturous, but I think the world will come out of it in a very different way. And one way it will come out of it is that it will be freer from us. Countries are going to have to find their way amidst staggering problems for which the United States has no solution, and it's in many ways a fundamental part of the problem. And it's going to require really an enormous renaissance of rethinking about how we go about incorporating billions of people who've been excluded. There was a study done by someone at the World Bank, not one of my favorite institutions, but he pointed out that 70% of the planet lives less well off than the bottom 5% of the United States. Now, if we lived in a human rights world where, in a way, this floor suddenly became glass, and everybody who was that 70% was underneath, and you had to do every action in your life thinking of those people, that's the kind of change in consciousness that would lead, I think, to greater change in the world. We don't know quite how to get there.
Fascinating, and this book is definitely a giant leap towards that end. Thank you so much for joining us on The Autograph, James Peck, and we hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to The Autograph at SusanMadaris.com. We're always looking forward to them. You can also follow me on Twitter for latest updates and discussions. Until next week and another show from all of us here in New York City, goodbye.